And the court will proceed to the fifth case, United States v. Hondros. Mr. Dvorak?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Dvorak. I represented Mr. Hondros in the trial court, both in the underlying case which provided the factual basis for this revocation as well as the revocation matter. The question before the court is the appropriateness of a clerk signing a warrant for arrest in a revocation context. In wondering why I bothered to bring this motion, I have to tell you that it was during the course of the underlying case I was wondering if they were ever going to file anything with respect to the revocation case, because we never received any kind of warrant, we never received any kind of notice that they intended to revoke it. Sometime in June or July, I went and looked in the court file, and lo and behold, there was a warrant that had been issued. And in looking at the warrant, I saw that the clerk had signed the warrant, and for some reason, that struck me. What's wrong with this picture? There's no authority for a clerk to sign a warrant in other contexts where there is authority. It is specifically put out in a statute, for example, in Rule 9, in various admiralty things, and in other places. But in no other places, it seems to me that it just does not appear to me, and it did not strike me as being a clerk function. Something for appropriate for a clerk to do, and it appears to me that that was the same response that the judge had in Crusco when he looked at the petition and said the petition, though signed, was not a summons, and then went to Rule 4 to look at the Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure Rule 4 to look at the appropriate form that a summons might take in this context.
Because we had a different temporal issue, didn't we, in that case? I mean, timing was critical there. We don't have that here, do we?
Well, timing is critical here. That's the only reason why we're here.
It was after the date in the Southern District case, right?
Correct.
We don't have an after date issue here, do we?
No, we don't have an after date issue here, unless, of course, the warrant is invalid.
Well, I didn't want you to waive the argument. I just wanted to set a factual difference.
That is correct. Yes. Yes.
But, you know, if the clerk's action had not been preceded by the district court judge's decision to grant the request for an arrest warrant, you would have a very strong argument, it seems to me. But here we have a judicial finding that the warrant should issue on the appropriate, you know, probable cause ground. And then what seems to be a ministerial act by the clerk in signing the actual piece of paper, and I guess it strikes me, this court, for instance, you know, the word the court sometimes means a panel of three judges, sometimes it means us as an institution at the district court level, sometimes it means the institution, sometimes not. And we haven't written down on a piece of paper every single instance where we've delegated authority to the clerk. I don't see why the clerk, with the critical fact of the prior district court judge finding, can't act as the judge's agent. Isn't it like 9B, essentially, of the criminal rules?
Right. However, in every context where the word court is used in the statutes, all the statutes that deal with revocation, with deal with probation, deal with supervised release, every time the word court is used, it is used meaning the judge, except in one place where it refers to the physical location of the building when it talked about jurisdiction. And it's what can a court do? What can a clerk do? And what can't a clerk do?
Or what can a judge delegate to the clerk?
Well, exactly.
The judge's act?
And that's the question. And I don't know, and that's why we're here, and there's no case law on it, as far as I know. And I guess that's the reason why I'm here. It's what struck me in the first place. I'm sorry.
No, that's
what struck me in the first place. Why is the clerk signing this warrant? I've got a man who's being, who could end up serving out the term of his sentence before this warrant arises, and all of a sudden he's going to be served with a warrant with the court's name on it.
If we could think this through for a second, I suppose this thing was handled telephonically with a judge, and then he telephonically or she directed the entry of the warrant by the... that would also trouble you under this approach. In other words, that the warrant issued... the judge handled the hearing telephonically or electronically in some fashion, you know, by video. Just was off-site. I'm thinking down the road because these things may evolve, already have, and then direct the ministerial act. Well, I don't want to color the argument. You would argue not ministerial, but direct the entry and issuance that day. And as a further thought, I wonder if in the case where we have that occurring, if we provided for the right to challenge that. In other words, wouldn't that give enough protection? In other words, established that there was this preceding judicial determination and this actual signing by a court designee, but a right to challenge, obviously. Wouldn't that afford all the protections and satisfy the spirit of the statute?
Are you suggesting that a right to challenge the...
Well, I mean, that actually...
the procedure itself?
A judge actually examined it so that there was no fraud upon a defendant by a court employee.
Yeah. Well, there's no question. I mean, it is analogous. It's analogous to what happened in this case, because what you're saying is that a judge did review it.
Yeah. I'm just trying to accommodate, if it's permissible, all the interest that would be at stake here. That is a meaningful judicial review and also an opportunity to challenge in the event that in fact no review occurred, but a warrant was issued through some inappropriate collaboration between, let's say, a law enforcement agent and a court employee.
Right. My point, Judge, is that I just don't think it's appropriate under the wording of the statute that a court sign this warrant. I don't think it's provided for in the statute. I don't think it's provided for really any place, I don't believe it is a ministerial function. And that's what I argued in my brief, and I would rest on my arguments in the brief. I don't know that I need to reiterate them here.
Interesting point. Makes us reflect on every kind of thing that Judge Wood has said when we vacate an oral argument, or enter, not quite the same thing in the warrant context. We issue an order by the court. May not have the hand of an individual, one of the 11 of us, but clearly the order goes out and we never touch a piece of paper. And so I'm just trying to think of the ramifications.
Yeah,
but it's an interesting point. It's far from not suggesting frivolous in any way.
It occurs to me also, Judge, in the other cases that I looked at in revocation context, most of them it is unclear exactly who exactly signed the warrant. But in the ones that was clear, it specifically stated that it was a judge that signed the warrant or the judge that signed the summons. It is just something that strikes me as being the appropriate way to do this.
Doesn't that speak to just how serious it is that there be a judicial function involved?
Oh, absolutely.
It's where one draws the line, where the function, the integral judicial function ends and any ministerial act, if any, occurs.
You're right, and what you're drawing the line there is between, I think, probably a constitutional issue, as Judge Edelman said, lurking behind all of this is a constitutional issue of a judicial finding of the appropriateness of issuing a warrant, whatever the standard might be. But the question here is indeed whether or not it's appropriate for a court to do it.
All right, thank you, Spark. Daniel? Oh, Ms. Daniel, excuse me.
I'm filling Gail Hoffman.
Oh, Gail Hoffman. And Ms. Hoffman, I should know that by this is far from your maiden appointment appearance here.
No, sir, I know there are many attorneys. I apologize for the...
You're replacing
I am, and it was my understanding that someone had sent a card in since I never saw it.
Well, we may have another ministerial question here.
Right.
Hopefully no heads will roll, but I'm glad to see you here.
Not from our end, at least.
No, not at this end either.
May it please the court, my name is Gail Hoffman, and counsel. I represent the United States of America. I did not represent the United States of America before the lower court. This is an interesting issue, and first of all, we do rest on our submissions. But apart from that, I would draw the court's attention to Title 28 United States Code, Section 956, which describes the functions of a clerk, which says, "The clerk of each court and his deputies shall exercise the powers and perform the duties assigned to them or ordered by the court." And I believe with those last words apply to this particular situation, because in this particular situation, we have Judge Edelman reviewing the petition of United States Probation Officer Sean Robinson, and by order of the court, just above, and turning the court's attention to the appellant's appendix, which includes the specific document. It's labeled as App 2. That's specifically the document that Judge Edelman signed. It lists all the violations, and above his signature, it says, "Praying that the court will order a warrant be issued so that Mr. Hondris's supervised release, which is due to expire on April 20th, 2001, be told pending the deposition of the alleged offense." And then underneath, there's order of the court, and it's considered in order this 18th day of April 2001, and ordered, filed, and made a part of the records in the above case. So taken together, it's the government's position that the clerk was ordered to issue a warrant by Judge Edelman. Judge Edelman made a probable cause finding that these violations occurred, and in fact, there is no dispute that the defendant did commit these violations. He was already in custody at the time this warrant was issued, and he, in fact, pled guilty to the offenses listed in the petition.
But Ms. Hoffman, it seems to me, 956 doesn't help us too much, because what Mr. Dvorak is trying to get us to focus on is exactly how much can the court delegate. I'm thinking this is a bit far afield, but if you remember the Supreme Court's decision in the Gran Financiera case, that's the one that dealt with whether the district courts could delegate certain powers to the bankruptcy judges, you know, which is certainly people different from personnel in the clerk's office. They have official appointments from the Court of Appeals and so on, and even there, the Supreme Court said, no, you've delegated too much power to Congress and delegated too much power to them. You couldn't do that, and so Congress had to go back to the drawing board, revamp the whole bankruptcy laws, and so the question is, when can the court delegate functions to non-judicial personnel? Is this the kind of thing, as in, let's say, Rule 4 of the criminal rules, that a judicial officer of some kind, their magistrate judge, has to do, or is this the kind of thing that can be delegated? And I think we need to focus on what it is that makes this a delegable function.
I don't think it is analogous to Rule 4. I mean, that's my opinion and the government's opinion. In that particular situation, Rule 4 says a magistrate judge must sign the arrest warrant or summons. I believe that statute is clear, that if you looked to the legislative history, which I didn't do, but if you looked to the legislative history, you would find that there's a reason that the word must is used. At that point, there's a determination of probable cause that the magistrate judge is making concurrently with the issuance of the warrant or the summons.
Well, that's the crucial fact.
Right.
It's a concurrent determination as opposed to the Rule 9 situation where the grand jury has made the probable cause determination, at which point we're all satisfied that it's there and there can be a delegation.
And it's our position that this is analogous to Rule 9, although there is some difference in the language,
right,
where in Section 3606, the language is, "The court having supervision of the petition, probationer or releasee may issue a warrant." And then Rule 9A requires, says, Rule 9A states that requires the court to issue a warrant, and then specifically Rule 9B specifies that the warrant or summons shall be signed by a clerk. But I think in this particular situation, the closer analogy is Rule 9, because under Rule 9 you have the grand jury, or in rare instances the United States Attorney, making a determination that there is probable cause, and then the clerk goes ahead and issues the summons or the warrant. And here you have a judicial, you have a body similar in many ways to a grand jury. The judge is on that, the district court judge is on the level of a grand jury in terms of making these, for purposes of analogy, they have, the grand jury has the power to authorize indictments, and the judge has the power to, for instance, accept an information that's filed when indictment is waived. So here you have a specific situation where the judge, who authorized the court to file a warrant. The judge found that probable cause occurred. He reviewed the violations. He said these violations occurred. He signed his name to the piece of paper, which incorporated all of that, and then that went to the clerk's office.
That signed paper also ordered that the warrant issue, right?
Well, yes, it did. Praying the court will order a warrant be issued. And then the judge, in the little section, incorporated that and made that part of the record.
Right.
And I think that from a policy perspective also, that there's a trend to streamline functions without jeopardizing rights of the defendant. And I think in this particular situation where you do have the judge making a probable cause determination, incorporating that into his order, and also incorporating that the court will order a warrant be issued, this is streamlining the process so the district court judge or a district court judge isn't responsible for signing, you know, every single ministerial piece of paper that comes before him or her during the course of her functions. As an aside, I handle the orphan probation revocation cases in my office, and so I see many transfer cases that come in, and I've looked at those files, and across the board, this is how it's handled in every district that I've looked at, and I've been, you know, handling that function in our office for many years, and while that's not part of this record, I would just like to make mention of that point, that other districts do handle it in the same fashion and have for many years. But barring any other questions, I would rest on the submission.
Speaking as to usage or custom usage, what we have before us, is that probably representative of the way either this judge or the Eastern District of Wisconsin?
In our district, because I do see these, I've seen these for a number of years, this is exactly how these warrants are issued in our district. This is not an exception to the rule. This is typical of what happened.
Mr. Dvorak just hadn't caught it before that, right?
Well, no one. I mean, I think in Mr. Dvorak's case, his client was in a situation different from any other defendants, because it was the warrant was issued on the eve of the expiration of the supervision, and so he looked at it closely to see, you know, what could he perhaps, I mean, I'm not trying to speak for Mr. Dvorak, but perhaps what could he do to knock this out? And then, as you're aware, the guidelines suggest that the sentences be consecutive. So he has his sentence on his original case, and then tacked on to it the 18 months or whatever he received in this case. But in many other situations, it's smack in the middle of a person's supervised release, and no one's really looking at that particular aspect of it so carefully.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman.
Thanks.
Mr. Dvorak?
First of all, I can't speak to custom and usage because I don't know what it is. I can only reiterate what I said before, that in the published cases, in any event that I've seen the judge sign the warrant. I agree that 950, the issue here is how far can we go with 956? And, you know, if we say that a judge can delegate the authority for a clerk to sign a warrant, why can't a judge delegate, after making a finding of probable cause, sign off on a complaint and tell a clerk to sign that warrant? Or, I mean, how far are we going to go? And it seems to me that the issuance of a warrant is an important enough of an act It's one that I guess I would associate traditionally as something that is judicially empowering and has a judicial
impact. How about a
lawyer
in an age of electronic filing with his signature or her signature electronically?
Then
be triggered
what we're
by somebody in the office just with the lawyer commanding
sure.
that the act that you transmit to the court your
but in that case, Judge, what we're saying is that there is a way for a judge electronically to sign the warrant by having his name on so ordered in the judge's signature. Well, that and if we say that comprises the judge's signature, then that warrant, that document, that order, whatever it is coming from the judge. It's not coming from the clerk. So there is a way for the court to do that. You're just saying that this will substitute from the ink on the paper. This is,
All right.
Digits.
All right.
Anything else?
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. Ms. Bork, in addition to thanks for your presentation, a special thanks for accepting the appointment and bringing this challenging question to the circus. Safe trip home to both of you.